Good morning. The Bible reading this morning comes from the book of Acts, chapter 18. Acts 18, the first eight verses. After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because of Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. And he went to see them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for they were tent makers by trade. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath, and tried to persuade Jews and Greeks. When Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with the word, testifying to the Jews that the Christ was Jesus. And when they opposed and reviled him, he shook out his garments and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." And he left there and went to the house of a man named Titius Justus, a worshiper of God. His house was next door to the synagogue. Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord together with his entire household, and many of the Corinthians, hearing Paul, believed and were baptized.
Good morning. With the new quarter begins a new series of lessons that I will be focusing on in these early morning talks. I'm going to be focusing on the six churches that received dedicated letters from the Apostle Paul. Not going to be focusing on the seven churches of Asia, which were mentioned in Revelation, but just those six that were able to be named as, you know, for the recipient of an epistle. Of course, Corinth and Thessalonica received two epistles, and I'll condense those into one lesson. So beginning this morning, we're going to be speaking about Corinth. John just read to us the first mention of Corinth in the New Testament account and spoke about how it came to be about. And based upon the wording, you could tell this was a growing church. Many of the Corinthians joined and listened to Paul and followed his words. Now, Corinth itself was one of the most celebrated cities in Greece. It was situated on a gulf that had the same name, and it was the capital of the region of Achaia. It was united to the continent by an isthmus, so it was kind of out on its own. It had a port on the west, the port of Lechium on the west, and the port of Centuria on the east. It had a lot of involvement with the commerce that took place on the Mediterranean Sea, basically extending from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way over to the port of Alexandria on the east. So its influence and its involvement with that region was pretty extensive. Some think that it was founded by a man named Sisyphus, who was the grandfather of Ulysses, and that it may have been established around 1504 BC. There are others that believe it came from it was set up by a man named Corinthus, and that's where it got its name. But it began as a very inconsequential town, but over time, especially up to the point where we see here in Paul, it had become a pretty powerful city in that area. It was destroyed by the Romans about 146 BC and was rebuilt, and that was the nature of the town at the time that we find the account in Acts chapter 18. It was a very magnificent city in the sense of its architecture and so forth. It had a lot of splendor and a lot of magnificence. There were temples, there were theaters, there were baths and porticos that they were well known for. It is also celebrated for its idol worship, its statues. Venus was worshipped there. Neptune, Diana, Apollo, Jupiter, and Minerva were just some of the different entities that were worshipped in that city. In particular, the Temple of Venus was very, very large, very, very well known. They said they had no less at any one time 1,000 courtesans on hand, which, you know what a courtesan is, you imagine they didn't have any shortage of visitors that were coming to meet with them. And it was because of its importance, it did change leaders quite often. I mentioned the Romans had come in 146 BC. And so there were a lot of power changes, power struggles, and had undergone a lot of different forms of government. But as of the writing of this epistle, it was back to being controlled by the Greeks. Now, Paul had established Corinth when he first visited there in about 52 AD. He was traveling from Macedonia to Jerusalem at that point in time. Mike will get to it in a short time here. But he had stayed there after he had come from Athens, where he had also preached the gospel. He came to Corinth alone, but in the passage that John read, we found that he had met with Aquila and Priscilla, who had come from Rome. I was thinking as John was reading that, how often, this was many years after Paul's conversion, but after he had been a tormentor of the Jews, and here he met with Aquila and Priscilla, who had just come from Rome, probably had not had too much dealings with the Church of Jerusalem that we could maybe surmise, and I just wondered, even this many years later, Paul still was having to defend himself and convince people that he was not there to torment them, he was there to convert them. And I wondered how that may have played out with Aquila and Priscilla. But that's a free point I'm throwing in there for you. He was with them, and he did wait there for the arrival of Silas and Timothy. When they arrived, Paul then preached the gospel to the Jews first, and then would go to the Greeks after that reception might not have been as he had intended. We know nothing regarding the size of the church. We don't know much about the converts themselves from this passage. And really, we only know what we know about Corinth from what we find in the two epistles. It's evident that the church, though, was kind of composed of those who were from what you might call more humble walks of life. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 26 through 31, Paul, in that first letter to them, wrote, "For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. And because of him you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, righteousness and sanctification and redemption, so that, as it is written, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord." It was a perfect example of how powerful the gospel can be. The gospel made people who were not powerful, who were not the smartest, who were not the most influential, powerful, because they had the gospel available to them. And even though this church was in a very influential city, they weren't necessarily attracting the power brokers of the world. And he was going to be, so the people that responded to Paul's message were those that were able to lower themselves in their mind and accept the gospel. Later, we know that Paul visited Corinth in 58 AD, about 6 years after he first met there. He spent the winter in Corinth as he was traveling from Macedonia to Jerusalem. And during his stay at Corinth, he wrote the epistle to the Romans while there in Corinth. So the timing and the place of the writing of this epistle is uniformly agreed that it was written while he was at Ephesus. The epistle seems to have been written after Paul had been at Corinth at least once, because he says in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 1, "And when I came to you, brothers, did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom." So this definitely implies he knew them, he was speaking to them directly as being well acquainted with them, and of course then mentions that he had come to them previously. It also seems to have been written when he was about to make another visit to the church. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 19, it reads, But I will come to you soon, if the Lord wills, and I will find out not the talk of these arrogant people, but their power. In 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 19, he tells them that Aquila and Priscilla send their greetings. We do know that Aquila and Priscilla were with Paul when he was at Ephesus, And proof of that is found in Acts 18, verse 26. Also in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 8, Paul tells them, "But I will stay in Ephesus until Pentecost." Because of these evidences, it's very likely that the epistle was written while Paul was at Ephesus. The circumstances which appear to be placing it at Ephesus also help us determine a time of its writing. From what we just read in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 8, it was indicated that he was in Ephesus when it was written, and the events in the book of Acts at that time can help us with that. In Acts chapter 19, verses 23 through 41, an account that's much too long for us to read this morning, it tells of the account of the riot that was caused by Demetrius. In Acts chapter 20, verse 1, we learn that Paul left for Macedonia to catch up with Timothy and Erastus. So this would seem to indicate that the apostle had been written prior to that departure. The events thought by historians here with the Demetrius riot occurred around 56 or 57 AD, so the epistle would be thought to be near this time. As far as the writer of the epistle, there's been no doubt that Paul was the person who wrote the epistle. There is a question whether this was the first letter that Paul had written to them, or whether he had previously written an epistle that we just don't have any knowledge of. The reason for this is based upon something that Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 9. "I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people." Whether he refers to another epistle which he wrote to them, or just maybe a letter that he had written to a different church that they had been able to read. These letters were often transcribed and sent on to other churches. We really do not know, but it does seem that this was not the first time that they were reading a letter that Paul had written. Now, the rest of my time is going to be talking about why this epistle was written, and then obviously why the second Corinthian epistle was written. From the epistle itself, we can learn that it was written as a reply to a letter which it had been addressed by the church of Corinth to Paul. We find this in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 11. The first part of that verse reads, "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote." So this would seem to be incorporating, this epistle would be incorporating responses to different matters that were included in that letter. The letter could have been sent by Paul and been delivered, or sent to Paul by Stephanus, Fortunatus, and Achaeus. The wording in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 17 and 18 seemed to indicate that they were members of the church at Corinth. As I get into this second part of the lesson, I won't be reading a lot of verses, but I do want to read this one. "I rejoice at the coming of Stephanus and Fortunatus and Achaeus, because they have made up for your absence, for they refresh my spirit as well as yours. Give recognition to such people." It wouldn't make much sense for Paul to be saying these men had come to him and refreshed his spirit, and he knew that it was going to refresh their spirit as well, meaning the people at Corinth, if they weren't familiar with these three men, and probably were the reason why they were there with him. And so it's very probable that they were the ones that had delivered the letter to which Paul is going to be responding partially through his letter. In addition to this, we know that Paul had heard reports of different activities that were going on there at the church. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 11 mentions that he had heard things from the people associated with Chloe. And the reports seem to have indicated that there were issues surrounding these particular topics. The divisions which had arisen in the church, partly because of who the different people were converted by, and they were forming kind of little bands of groups or little divisions. You know, I am of Paul, I am of Apollos, I am of Cephas, or I am of Christ. These things were being stressed to kind of determine who they were loyal towards. And that was not the point of why Paul had gone there to preach. He wasn't wanting to convert people to Paul. He was wanting to convert people to Christ. And so he needed to make it known that this was not something that they should be pursuing. There are also some there that were questioning his authority as an apostle. And he had to then address that. There also seems to indicate that there was a false teacher among them. And that person might have been the person that was trying to discredit Paul for their purposes. Historians think that this person was a fellow Jew, probably from the Sadducees, and this is the reason why Paul spends the entire 15th chapter talking about the resurrection of the dead. And so that is thought of, that is why that is in this letter. The Corinthians were Greeks for the most part, and as we know about Greeks, they're very philosophical in nature. They like to think about new things, and so it's thought that this church being in Greece full of Greek citizens could be swayed by people coming in, speaking very eloquently, speaking very authoritatively, and that they were in danger of basically having their faith taken in a direction that they did not want it to go. Some of the other specific situations which Paul addressed in the first letter, obviously the well-known case that's found in chapter 5 of the man who was sleeping with his father's wife. They were told that they needed to put away this man and they needed to separate themselves from him. The church had been tolerant of them, of this situation up until then, and Paul gave them very strongly worded direction on how they should be removing this man from upon them. And he needed to use this man as an example of the way they should be disciplining members of their congregation. The Corinthians also had an eagerness to go to court, and that included taking their fellow brothers and sisters to court. Paul said this brought shame upon them, and that they didn't need to be, for lack of a better term, airing their dirty laundry in a secular court. He stressed to them the importance that they were able to handle these things internally, that through love and not through litigation, they should be able to handle any differences that would come up among them. There also were, probably under the influence of these false teachers, there had been some erroneous views and some practices that they had begun to take care of. That was addressed in the 6th chapter of 1 Corinthians. A lot of the sins that were mentioned there, he said, you did these before you became Christians. In your former lives, you did these things. There's no need to go back to them. There's no benefit in going back and getting involved in these types of sins before. Paul tells them to glorify God in their bodies. They should not be glorifying themselves or pleasing themselves in their bodies. And then, as I mentioned in chapter 7, he then starts to address the issues that were mentioned in the letter that he had received from them. He spoke to them about marriage and the duties in regard to the circumstances that they were finding themselves in, dealing with the one man. The eating of things that were offered to idols is in chapter 8 of 1 Corinthians. And some other subjects that were likely submitted to him through the letter were the nature of spiritual gifts, the purpose of speaking in tongues, the proper order, or how the worship should be orderly. That, of course, is a passage we read oftentimes when we are preparing our minds for the Lord's Supper, telling them that it needed to be done in a certain way, with a certain attitude, and that was something that needed to be addressed to them. He concludes with chapter 15, where I had mentioned about where he spent quite a bit of time talking about the resurrection of the dead, and he closes the epistle with some further directions and general salutations. And so that was the basis of the letter that he wrote, at least this letter that we know he wrote to the Corinthians that we have labeled the 1 Corinthian epistle. Now, of course, we know there is a second letter that he wrote to the Corinthians. Obviously, I don't need to go back and talk about the beginning of the church there, so I'll jump right to the time and the place where the epistle is thought to have been written. The epistle was written from Macedonia and was sent by Titus to the church at Corinth. If this is the case, it was written probably about a year after the first epistle, so that would put it 59 to 60-ish, depending upon whether 58 or 59 was the right date, but right around 59 AD generally is when this epistle was written. We know that Paul was on his way to Corinth and was expected to go there soon, but even though he had told them in the 1 Corinthian letter that he wanted to be, or that he would be coming to visit them, that had not occurred yet, and he was still hopeful of arriving there. He had left Ephesus, where he was when he wrote the first epistle, and had gone to Macedonia and met up with Titus, and at that time he received an update to how they had received the first letter, what reaction what the reaction had been. And so that was a lot of why the second epistle was written, addressing the report that he had gotten about them after the sending of the first epistle. The first epistle was very disciplinary. It was very harsh and severe. Paul recognizes that in this second letter. He knows that it was a pretty harshly worded letter. And he was now writing to point out, you know, how they had handled it. There were a lot of problems that were mentioned in that first epistle. And so a lot of this second epistle was dedicated to continuing to strive to them to continue on and to continue to improve. It's natural that he should feel great happiness at the reception of how they received the first letter. He expressed his pleasure that they accepted his disciplinary tone and for the most part had responded accordingly and appropriately. The act of discipline which he had directed had been performed, the errors had been corrected, and the Corinthians were showing a true repentance about how they had been acting. They were gladly receiving Paul's direction and responding to it. So with this news in Paul's mind, he writes this second letter. Now Titus had an opportunity to learn the views of the members, how they had responded to Paul's letter, and he was able to then tell Paul how Paul's character in some level had been vindicated, and this letter was delivered by Titus so that he could help. This second letter, I should say, was delivered by Titus so that he could continue to help encourage the Corinthians to have these positive improvements to their approach to the gospel. And then the last thing, he was hopeful that they would receive the second letter in the same spirit that they had received the first. Now, some of the subjects that are mentioned in this epistle, and my time is quickly running out, this letter speaks about a variety of topics mainly that do not appear to have any necessary flow, or they don't necessarily build upon each other, but he's speaking on this variety of topics that he knew they needed to hear. Some of the subjects of which he talks about are useful to the Corinthian church, but it's also useful to us as well. There are some of the topics that are in this second letter, 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 1 through 12. He mentions his own sufferings, particularly from the churches of Asia. And he expresses his gratitude for God for having experienced those troubles. And he expresses gratitude for his ability to have been delivered from those trials. And he states the reasons for which God had called him to endure them, which it allowed him to be better qualified to comfort others, including those at Corinth, who might be afflicted in a similar way. And so he was letting them know that when they're afflicted, they can overcome it just as Paul had. In verses 13 and 24 of that first chapter, he continues to vindicate himself from some of the accusations that were continuing to be brought against him. One was that he was unreliable or fickle-minded. He talks about Paul didn't say yes, yes, and no, no. He wasn't flip-flopping, and he in particular because he hadn't been there yet. There were people who were using that to their advantage to question Paul, and he was saying, I had reasons for not coming to them, and he spells them out. And he also says that maybe the true reason why he had not come was he wanted to spare them. After such a harsh letter, a possible visit from Paul right then may have seemed too authoritative or too authoritarian, I guess is probably the word I'm looking at. And because of that, he wanted to spare them from any additional, you know, beating of a dead horse type situation is how I read it. Second chapter, we learn about the resolution of the man who had been sleeping with his father's wife. He had responded positively to the punishment, the removal of him from the congregation. And then he tells them, and I spoke on this just recently, that they needed to be comforting him. They should continue to belittle him or point out his previous errors. Now that he had come back, they were strongly encouraged to comfort him and to welcome him back. Paul vindicates his character further in his claims that he had regarding to being an apostle. Chapter 3, he assures them that they should not need any letters of commendation from him to prove who he was. They knew him. They had met with him previously. They were fully acquainted with him. There was no need for him to be continuously stressing to them who he was. And this subject then leads into an examination of the nature of his ministry and how important it was, which he illustrates this by talking about the ministry of death, which was the Mosaical law, for the ministry of the Spirit. The Mosaical law was full of glory, but the ministry of the Spirit was capable of so much more glory. He doesn't cut down the Mosaical law. He's saying it was a wonderful thing for what it was, but now that we are in this ministry of the Spirit, there was so much more glory. The former was temporary. This ministry was a permanent ministry. In chapters 4 and 5, he states the principles by which he came into the ministry. He and the other apostles had been greatly afflicted. They were subject to different trials. They were sustained, though, because they had the hope of heaven available to them. And there was an assurance that there was a path to that heavenly place. And he had gone forth to convince people that this is the attitude they needed to have. Chapter 6 talks about, he offers a conciliatory tone and tells them how much he cared for them. He then exhorts them to avoid relationships which would harm their faith, improper marriages, dealing with people who were idol worshipers. They didn't need the titles, the temples that were built for idols. They themselves were temples that were in service to God. They didn't need to go to external temples. They had the promise that God had made to them that would be fulfilled with them. Chapters 8 and 9, Paul discusses the collection for poor and afflicted Corinthians or Christians in different areas, and he basically says, I've spoke highly about you to the Macedonians, so when they come, I want you to be prepared, because if you're not prepared after I've talked so highly of you, you're going to humiliate yourselves and you're going to humiliate me. So he urged them that they would be ready. And then starting from chapter 10, going through the rest of the book, he continues to offer a vindication of himself about his apostolic authority against those who were trying to discredit him. He ends the book by imploring them to heed these words so that when he visits them this third time, he would not have reason to continue severely using his authority to discipline them. In 2 weeks, we will, of course, discuss, if we go right in the chronological order, well, in the order in which we find them in the Bible, we'll be talking about the Galatian church. At this time, Brother Cliff will lead us in a closing prayer, and we will go to our class.
Lord, we thank you for another Lord's Day.